This episode is brought to you by Clark's Herbal Remedies. Anytime my old high school football knee injury is acting up, Clark's Herbal Remedies all-natural pain cream is my go-to for fast relief. This stuff doesn't come from a factory. It's small batch and handcrafted by an herbalist who sources the best ingredients from around the world. In my experience, this pain cream from Clark's Herbal Remedies really works. You can order a jar today at clarksherbs.com. Use discount code JFK for 20% off. That's clarksherbs.com.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Recently, we wrapped up season 2 of Solving JFK, and we'll be coming back with season 3 in a few months. But today, we have a special bonus episode. It's a debate slash discussion with author Fred Litwin about the issues surrounding Oswald's time in New Orleans. Now, I haven't done any debates on the JFK assassination yet, primarily because I take rebuttals as I go along and I review them as I'm covering each topic. Also, I'm trying to systematically cover everything, and so it's kind of hard to stop as I'm going along the way to go back and deal with things that I've already covered. But I've decided that I'm going to do a whole season of debates and discussions after I get done with season 3 of the podcast. So, you know, because I think once I'm done with that, I'll have a lot of questions and I'll also need to have holes poked in any things that I may be saying. You're a good hole poker in terms of, you know, just pointing out arguments that might be weak, Mr. Litwin. So, anyway, I would probably have you back again as when we get deeper into debates.
Sure.
But having said that, I do believe that discussion with people with, you know, opposing viewpoints or, you know, not overlapping viewpoints is a valuable thing. And, you know, I think that while sometimes there are disputes about the facts, there are just as often disputes about, you know, what reasonable inferences can be drawn from a given fact pattern. Just like, you know, jurors can sit there and hear the same information in a trial and reach different conclusions because they have different inferences. So,
yeah, for sure.
And we'll touch on that too, as we get going. But back in late July, after we were wrapping up the series on Oswald in New Orleans, Fred, you reached out to me after I had tweeted about the episode, basically saying you'd like to discuss it more. And so here we are.
Yeah.
My guest today is author, researcher, and Warren Report defender, Fred Litwin. Fred, welcome to Solving JFK.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And let me ask you, how would you like me to, is Warren Report defender okay? Is there a
well, I think the problem with Warren Report defender is that if you read my book, I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak, I have some pretty stern critiques of the Warren report in there. So I'm not, you know, I support the fact that a lone gunman killed Kennedy.
Got it. So lone gunman supporter, is that
yeah.
It's hard because then it sounds like you're supporting some lone gunman running around doing things.
Yeah.
And then when you say lone nutter, it sounds like you're calling you a nut.
Well, also, I don't know whether Oswald, lone nut, I mean, the problem with lone nut, I don't know if Oswald was a nut.
Right.
He was a lone gunman for sure, but not sure.
Well, part. Let's jump. We're going to cover about 6% of the the JFK case, 1% maybe, but I think it'll be good, and points and counterpoints.
Yep.
So, but before we get started, Fred, I do want to give you credit where it's due for your commitment to the documents and the primary research. As I was going through, and I don't know if you saw or heard any of the podcast or saw any of the material, but I cited you quite a few times, just as a counterpoint for the main conclusion. Now, sometimes I found that your research was persuasive to me, and I kind of ended up being on the same page as you. Other times, it didn't ultimately persuade me, but but it definitely made it clear that, hey, this isn't maybe necessarily a slam dunk. So anyway, I think, like I said, you know, we're going to agree on some things and disagree on some things, but the fact that you have unearthed these documents and you have the primary resources, I think everyone can appreciate that. So thank you for your work on that, Fred.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's very important to go to the archives, and I've been to every archive I could find that is primary Garrison material.
Yeah, and you went to, so that would be College Park, Maryland. I think you also said you went to Baylor.
I've been to Boston University. I've been to Baylor, of course, here in Ottawa, the papers of Lewis Bloomfield about Permindex and CMC. And I've been to the Sixth Floor Museum, and I've, you know, New Orleans as well, to et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Well, let's jump into it here. Let's just kind of start with the issue. So first one, Riley Coffee Company. So the big question is, there's a couple questions. One, did Riley Coffee Company have any intelligence connections? Sort of, is it a place where Oswald was going as part of an intelligence assignment? The facts that would point to it potentially having intelligence connections are really the connections of William Riley, the owner. But he financed a couple groups. He financed Sergio Arcacha Smith's group, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, and he also donated to INCA, Ed Butler's group, the Information Council of the Americas. And there's a CIA document, by the way, that says that Butler was a cooperative contact and was always welcomed an opportunity to assist the CIA. But again, this is Riley just donated to these groups that have these ties. Doesn't mean he's in the groups. Jerry Hemming told Jim Garrison that Riley worked for the CIA. There's a 1949 CIA memo that says Riley Coffee was of interest and had an agency number assigned to it, but really nothing further there. You know, in my view, there's a FBI, somebody in the FBI who worked, who was like a VP, Monahan, I think his name was, at Riley Coffee. So, you know, there were some little points, but there was no real proof of Riley being any sort of clear intelligence connection. Although, you know, the owner was certainly anti-communist in his personal beliefs. Your thoughts on Riley Coffee?
Well, I think if you look at the, if you were part of an anti-Castro group in New Orleans and you wanted to raise money, you're certainly going to go to the people who have money in New Orleans. And so where do you go? You go to businessmen who tend to have money asking for your cause. And fighting communism, being anti-Castro, being anti-communist was a pretty popular viewpoint or cause in New Orleans. And so it's not surprising that people like Sergio Arcacha Smith and others would raise money from wealthy businessmen in New Orleans. So that doesn't surprise me. And the question is, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. And then the other, so the first point really goes into the next thing, which is there some sort of connection between Riley Coffee and NASA or NASA contractors, you know, Michu, it's not Michaud. That's a rookie mistake I've learned. And anyway, yeah. But I thought this was one of the things that I thought was persuasive, you know, on your blog. You pointed out that NASA basically and contractors were opening new plants around the time. It was a high paying job. So, you know, the mere fact that you've got a bunch of people going to work at these places doesn't necessarily prove anything. Now, the counter to that is that there were four people who left while Oswald was at Riley, and two of them were his bosses, and then two of them were coworkers that he knew. So in other words, they worked with Oswald. Now, of course, I know you could zoom in with a microscope to those statements I just made, right, and knock them around a little bit. But I guess maybe you know the answer to this better than me. My answer on whether that was fishy, that there were four people that left to go to NASA, really just depended on, like, how many people worked there. You know what I mean? And so do you have any idea how many worked there? It was a decent
at NASA
number.
Well, there was several different plants. So I think there was Boeing and Chrysler and other people. And so there were thousands of jobs there.
I meant at Riley, sorry.
Oh, at Riley. I'm not sure. I don't really know.
I mean, I would imagine it's got to be, I mean, that's the whole question. Is it like, do you have a 20% of people leaving? And I can't imagine four people leaving would be that. So
well,
it's
also, yeah. There's probably a revolving door of people who are, you know, leaving, coming in, leaving, coming in. So yeah. There's probably a large number of actual employees if you count the total number.
Right.
And so how many of them actually end up in Michu is a good question, but I'm not sure.
And it also wasn't all going to the same, saying NASA and contractors of NASA, that's a big bucket, So it's not all the exact same thing. So yeah, I mean, to me, now that doesn't mean that it definitely wasn't. It just means that there's not any evidence to support it. And if there's not evidence to support it, then my view is let's talk about something else because it's kind of a dead end.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So let's go to the next one. This is a fun one that I think you'll enjoy. This is one that I get maybe the most grief about of any of my takes. Do you believe that Judith Vary Baker is a credible source when it comes to her story that she shared about her and Oswald?
No, definitely not. I don't think there's many. I mean, obviously she's the leader of a cult, so there are people who do believe her. But I don't think the most credible assassination critics or non-critics, none of them really believe her story.
Yeah, and I mean, for people who don't know, and we did cover it on the podcast, but basically this woman says that she worked at Riley Coffee when Oswald was there and that she was his mistress. And then she kind of goes on to, it's sort of like a Warren Report critic's dream testimony of filling in all the gaps of all these people. But the problem is there's a few issues. First of all, let me tell you why she may be credible. let me tell you why what people hang their hat on. Okay. She appears to be a legit science scholar coming out of high school. There does seem to be some support for that. I mean, there's a newspaper article that says that she got to go to this camp. Let's get your take on this. David Ferry was found with, when they went to his apartment, he did have like lab mice at his apartment, correct?
No, not when he died. That his lab mice were in the 1950s.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to zoom into that. My understanding was, is there not a Garrison report that says that there was? Okay. All right. No. So anyway, and then Mary Sherman, who Judith Vary Baker says she worked with, it is true that she was mysteriously killed, right? And I don't believe that has been solved to date, has it?
Yeah. No, you're right.
So there's some intrigue there. I get that. And then the thing that's probably the best thing she has is she's got the W-2 statement that says she worked at Riley Coffee. My challenge with that, just given the significance of how big of a claim it is that she's making, I don't believe it's ever been, that W-2 has been verified. I've looked at it. I bought the book so I could see the document. But do you have a thought on the authenticity of that W-2? Like, do you think she worked there and she made it up, or is the whole thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at it. I think that she may very well have worked at Riley Coffee Company, but that's about as far as she's actually provided no other evidence of her relationship with Oswald, but beyond that, which doesn't show a relationship.
Yeah. And so let's talk about the counterpoints, and this sold me the counterpoint. I've met this woman a couple times, and I've been in an elevator with her one time. And I don't mean any ill will, but she's coming forward with this, representation of this major thing with American history. And a lot of people believe what she has to say. So I think it's worth maybe a little pushback to some extent. No one at Riley remembers seeing her there. There's no proof of her ties to Dr. Ochsner. There's no proof of her ties to Dr. Sherman. And my biggest thing there's the whole story of Clay Shaw paid for Judith and Lee to rendezvous at hotels during the day because he felt bad for them. But so that was, I always thought that was nice of Clay Shaw to do.
Yeah, nice guy.
And anyway, but the big question is, two big questions. Why wouldn't she come forward to the HSCA or the ARRB? And then the other thing is just the whole story. If the CIA was going to make a fast-acting cancer, why would they have Oswald? And let's say if you would grant me for a moment that Oswald is a false defector and he is some sort of CIA asset. No, that's not what you believe. But even if that were true, why would you have this random person who, if anything, is a low-level asset, work on curing cancer with David Ferry, who also has no background in biology? The story just seemed, no one could ever connect those dots for me.
Right.
So anyway, all right. So there we go. Hey, look at that. We're on the same page.
By the way, I posted a picture of Judith on my blog this week because I saw her, in Daley Plaza. So she, I was sort of talking, I was taking pictures of some of the QAnon people who were there, and she ran over to speak to them. So I have a very good picture of Judith sort of looking at me after she had spoken to them.
yeah, actually I did see that. So yeah, that's interesting. All right, well, let's move on to another topic. Hey, I think so far we're either inconclusive or on the same page, but
Right.
I think things are going to start to diverge here. So here we go. All right. Generally speaking, so without getting specifically into Oswald or not, I just want to talk about what Guy Bannister was up to in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. Okay, so I'll just kind of lay out what we covered, and then if you have thoughts or counterpoints, then you can chime in. So on the podcast, we covered how Bannister, when he worked with the FBI and he made it to special agent in charge of the Chicago office, one of the things he did was work to develop informers that would infiltrate leftist groups. And then, according to Joe Oster, he worked with Bannister, and Bannister turned down some private lucrative investigations. And Oster also said that Bannister could get J. Edgar Hoover on the phone, which I guess isn't too crazy given that Bannister was formerly, the SAC in the Chicago office. But the point is, it paints a picture of Bannister kind of not being fully out of the game, I guess. Former Bannister employee Joe Nubro said that Bannister was a conduit of CIA funds. There is a CIA memo that says the agency considered using Bannister in 1960, but it did not. And there are multiple witnesses that said some of the munitions from the Schlumberger, not Schlumberger, Schlumberger raid were
As a
stored.
Canadian, I know that, but
Schlumberger, and it was in Houma, not Schlumberger in Houma. I got it. I got it. Anyway, but Bannister performed. But so there are multiple witnesses that say that there were these munitions in Bannister's office. There's a newspaper story about it. Bannister performed background checks on LSU students on behalf of Sergio Arcacha Smith's Cuban Revolutionary Council. The conclusion I came to is that Bannister was doing some other work. I don't think he was completely not accepting private work, but it seemed like he had these college age informants that were in that were infiltrating leftist groups. So it seemed like he was kind of up to the same old stuff he had done before at the FBI. What is your, do you think Guy Bannister, when he had his private detective agency, was truly just a private detective agency? Do you think he was doing any work for any government agencies, or is it hard to say, or do you have a perspective on that?
Well, I think we have to look at the time and the when. So Guy Bannister starts this agency, and we have a man who was very powerful, starts a detective agency, and maybe he could get Hoover on the phone, has lots of contacts and lots of ideas, and certainly he did store those weapons from Schlumberger. But then there's a downward slide, and Bannister really starts to go downhill. He can't pay his rent. He's drinking more, he becomes more violent. What he's really concerned with is in his detective agency, and you can see some of the, I don't know if you have any of the reports he actually wrote, but he had a newsletter that he actually distributed, which is all about segregation, integration,
Right.
segregation. He was sort of a white supremacist, along with Delphine Roberts, who worked for him, who was particularly crazy. And so he couldn't pay his rent, and he was ultimately evicted. In fact, he went to work in a high school as a security guard. So this is a man who, yes, in 1961, sort of kind of interesting, and there might have been some stuff going on there. Clearly involved in the anti-Cuba cause and the Schlumberger, and he knew all those people. And there was a slow decline of the man, so that by 1963 and into 64, I mean, he was evicted, everything was repossessed, he was a drunk, a violent drunk, and there's nothing there.
When was he evicted? I
Well,
don't.
he was evicted. I have to go to my files. He was evicted by he had like 8 months that he hadn't paid his rent, and so he was evicted, I think, sometime in 1964. But it was like over 8 months of rent, since so they possessed his furniture and stuff and his files and everything else.
All right, well, let's keeping it on Bannister. Let's look at the Bolton Ford story. I guess this is on Bannister, but tangential to Bannister. Just quickly talk about the Bolton Ford story here. So what we laid out is, you know, Oscar Desplat was the assistant manager at Bolton Ford. And in January of 1961, when Oswald is in Minsk, Desplat dealt with two people who were looking to buy 10 trucks on behalf of the Friends of Democratic Cuba. And that was an organization whose incorporators included Guy Bannister and Oswald's old boss at Tujag's, Gerard Tujag, which that's weird, right? And I don't even think it means anything. I'm not saying, and aha, look at this. But that is weird, isn't it? Small world.
Well, it is a small world. I mean, if you look into my background, I mean, you'll find that I have mob connections. And isn't that weird that I have, you know, my best friend growing up, his uncle was a high-ranking official in the mob in Quebec. In fact, he was the go-between between the Quebec premier and Meyer Lansky, right next door to me. I was friends with him. Okay, it's weird.
It is interesting. And so how long has the mafia been recruiting you, Fred?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. So, but, you know, it almost reminds me of the thing of Oswald's mom's divorce lawyer. The first time she got divorced, went on to be the Secretary of the Navy, I believe. Right? Isn't that right?
Something like that. I mean,
and then Oswald wrote him a letter to try to get reinstated. It's just like, this is so I'm not this isn't really making a statement about the case. It's just making a statement of like, that is a coincidence. I would say coincidence. Okay. So just to be clear, I'm not trying to make a connection there,
right?
But that is the real challenge here, trying to sort coincidence from you know, connection that's meaningful. So but anyway, Oscar Desplat, he's the manager there at Bolton Ford, and he's interviewed two and a half years after the incident. But he does have this order form that says Oswald on it. And Desplat says he remembered two men came in. Joseph Moore was one of them. And it says Jose Moore is the first name you can easily read. And then he said that the other guy said that they should put his name down because he's the one paying for it. And he just wrote Oswald for his name. So now I don't think this is Lee Harvey Oswald. And by the way, nobody, Desplat didn't say that it looked like Oswald either. And we know Oswald's in Minsk. But it is weird. Now, it's also inconsistent with the other Oswald impersonations, because in those ones, it's the argument is that, you know, Oswald's being made to look like he's this pro-Castro, do anything for Castro, pro-Cuba guy. But here, this is taking actions on the other side of the coin, the anti-Castro actions. But I don't know. You got Oswald's name and you got the Bannister connection, something related to Cuba. So I don't have an explanation for it now, but
you've seen my explanation, right? Have you?
Yes, I have. I'd like you, if you go ahead.
I was never that interested in this story, actually. You know, I was going to the archives and I'm copying, photographing the Metropolitan Community Crime Commission in New Orleans and various papers. And there's lots of stuff about Bolton Ford that I photographed, and I was never that interested in it. But one day I was doing a Google search on Bolton Ford and Oswald, and up popped a court case. And it was a court case of Bolton Ford versus Shulin Camp Motors, which was right next door. And Shulin Camp Motors was owned by Oswald Shulin Camp. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. His name was Oswald. I never even thought about Oswald as a first name. So I thought, well, this could have been him. He could have been the guy to go in there. And my friend Steve Rowe found a newspaper article, a picture in the Times Picayune of Oswald Schulenkamp's brother, who was a judge, sitting at on New Year's Day with Guy Bannister. So I said, wow, that's an incredible connection. There's, you know, the Schulenkamps might be very, very active in the anti-Castro movement. And Shulin Camp Motors didn't sell trucks. And maybe Joseph Moore went to Shulin Camp Motors and Oswald said, I'll take you next door and, you know, I want to help you. And he was the one who whose name is on the order form.
Mm. I think that's an interesting and not implausible theory. I mean, I get it. Especially the picture, I think, is the strongest thing there. But my question would be, so beyond the picture, is that all we have to support that this Oswald Schulenkamp guy maybe?
I spoke to Oswald Schulenkamp's son. in New Orleans. I mean, I wanted to do some more research about, were they, were they, what work did they do for the anti-Castro Cuban cause? And unfortunately, he was too young to really know much about his father's politics, so he just didn't know. And I don't know if there was any other family members who, I tried calling a lot of Shulin camps in
Sure.
New Orleans. There's actually quite a few, but
I
but
got it.
I couldn't find anything. And I do think that, I think the interesting thing here is that as more archives get online, perhaps we will find more about Oswald and his brother's involvement in some sort of anti-Castro group, but I couldn't find much right now.
And the so yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, that when I looked at your blog on this, my first thought was no way. And then I saw the picture and I was like, oh man, maybe. But I will say, if the guys were so if you're working at Bolton Ford, wouldn't they know the guy who owns the thing next door to them? Wouldn't the slat have been able to that would be my pushback on it, you know what I
Yeah, no,
mean?
I don't know. I mean, you're a salesman at another company, and you may not know exactly who owns the company next door. You're focused on your work. It's quite possible
Yeah.
who was, maybe you just don't know who Oswald Schulenkamp is.
Yeah, and I mean,
And
I don't
the
think.
other possibility is that he did know, and he really didn't want to get trouble with the company next door and tell the Warren Commission about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that we'll ever know for sure, but good luck trying to hunt down the Oswald Schulenkamp angle. That's not nothing. I mean, and especially because it didn't say Lee Oswald. It said Oswald.
Yeah, and by the way,
But
I actually, if you go to ancestry.com, I actually wanted to see how many Oswalds were in the phone book in 1961. And there's around 26 different Oswalds in the phone book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the Warren Report critic side, this has always just been a crazy story, and it was never really connected to anything. So, that's cool. Let's move on to the next things. Now we're getting into the real disagreement zone. We had a nice little friendly warm up. Here
Okay,
we
yes,
go.
good.
We'll keep it cordial. All right. Next thing. Did Oswald work for Guy Bannister in the summer of 1963? Now, my answer is I believe he did. Your answer, I believe, is that he did not. So in total, on my podcast, we covered 11 people who said that they saw Oswald at Guy Bannister's office, or they saw him talking to Bannister, if not at his office. So I just want to kind of run through those folks. And you've done really good work on testing the witness credibility with these. So yeah, we'll run through them here. All right, so Delphine Roberts, she's the first one. And the first two are the HSCA ones that I'm gonna hit on. So Delphine Roberts and Jack Martin. So Roberts told the HSCA investigators that Oswald first entered Bannister's office in May of 1963, and that he was in the office many times that summer and was on familiar terms with Bannister. But Roberts didn't mention that, what I just said, the first time that she spoke to the HSCA. And she also didn't mention it when she spoke to Garrison's investigators in 1967. And so because of that, the HSCA found her unreliable. I know she was also super duper racist, and she was also Guy Bannister's mistress as well. So my question to you is, so I understand the argument against Delphine Roberts' credibility given the timing of the statements. My question is, what do you think her motive was to make it up if she didn't believe it was true?
Hard one to say. I mean, I think that when she first told the story, I think it was to Anthony Summers, and I think she was paid, so there may have been some money involved. As to why she, and by the way, she didn't come forward to the Warren Commission either. She didn't come forward to the FBI or the Warren Commission in 63, 64. She didn't tell Garrison in 67, and she waited until the late 70s before she finally said something. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know. People have lots of motives for telling all sorts of stories, and we have no shortage of witnesses who have crazy stories, just like Richard Case Nagel being one. So I don't know exactly. Well, in that case, I know why, because he had brain damage, but I don't know why she did it. I mean, she just may have felt she wanted to be important, or, you know, who knows what was going on in her life at the time.
Right. Yeah, because that's the theme of this podcast, and the theme I think you'll find of our areas of disagreement are just when there's so many people saying the same thing, it's hard for me to get my head around why they would do that if there wasn't some fire there where the smoke's coming from.
Yeah,
So
the one thing I would add is that what happens in this case a lot is you have a sort of a feedback mechanism. So, like Richard Casenagel would be a very, very good example. When William Martin from Garrison's office goes to interview Richard Casenagel in prison, the first question that Nagel asks him is, "What's your theory? Can you tell me your theory?" And then Martin tells him the theory, and Nagel says, "Oh yes, you're right. Yes." And then once you know that David Ferry is part of your theory, so he feeds back to Martin, "Oh yes, David Ferry was definitely part of it." And then it goes back to Gary, "Oh yes, we have confirmation that David Ferry was part of it." And so you see this over and over again. And then Nagel did the same thing with Dick Russell. He's talking with Dick Russell about, you know, what's going on, and Nagel said to Dick Russell, "You write to me. You write me your theory, and I'll comment on your theory." And so you see this all the time of people feeding back, and then it becomes another witness who says this.
Well, I would love to see you talk to Dick Russell about Nagel. That is not a topic that I have not read the full book on Nagel. From but I did you know I'm hip to the overview, and then I'm hip to the counterpoints on Nagel, but there are so many other things, so I won't really chime in too far on that, other than to
Yeah.
say that
And it's not just Nagel. I'm not really, I didn't bring that up because of Nagel, but it's just interesting that sometimes, you know, it's easy for a witness to feed back what the other person wants to hear, and then it becomes a corroborating point for that thing. And Jack Martin, I mean, first off,
it's for
Jack
Jack Martin, yeah.
Martin never brought up Oswald. When Jack Martin first contacted everybody the weekend of the assassination, I mean, he called the FBI, he called the Secret Service, he called the FAA, he called the newspapers, he called everybody he could think of to talk about how horrible David Ferry was. But he never mentioned Oswald being in Banisher's office. That only came later. And of course, I actually transcribed an interview, a tape recording of which I put on YouTube of Garrison and Jack Martin, in which he talks about, you know, Oswald being in Bannister's office. And you could see in that interview, I mean, Garrison keeps on asking him, "When was Oswald there? When was Oswald there?" And he's really reluctant to answer it. And he says, "Well, he was there this time, and that I saw him with Sergio Arcacha Smith, but I saw him that." And you could really sense that there was nothing specific behind Martin. He was very reluctant to really talk about it. He's a
So
completely unreliable witness.
let's talk Jack Martin. So the
Yeah.
thing that he said to the HSCA is that he saw Oswald in Bannister's office in 1963 with David Ferry, and he also told Jim Garrison's investigators the same thing in 1966, correct?
Yep.
But to your point, he did not say that immediately after the assassination in the wake of all of it in 1963,
And he
right?
was saying
That's
everything. I mean, he was saying
right.
everything after the assassination. But you know, even if he had said it after the assassination, he had no credibility on anything. I mean, yes, he certainly knew David Ferry. He had a grudge against David Ferry, so he was really trying his best to get David Ferry into trouble.
And he was a drunk, and his real like a severe alcoholic, is my understanding. It was a problem for him.
Yep.
And his real name was Ed Suggs. Is that right?
Yep. Edward
So
Suggs, and he was wanted for murder in
really,
down in Dallas for doing an abortion.
so I might. The counterpoint I would have on I did not know. Sorry, I was what you just said was sinking in.
Yeah.
The counterpoint I would have on why Jack Martin maybe didn't say anything about Oswald in the office right after the assassination. I mean, even though he had gotten into this fight with Bannister, and this is, I will say, this is speculation. This does not prove anything, but
Yeah, of course.
Bannister, it seems like he would know that, like, that's a nuclear bomb. If I bring up Oswald, that's going to be a whole thing. And then maybe after Bannister died, that could have changed his perspective. But I'll tell you that if it was Jack Martin and Delphine Roberts alone, I none of this would be persuasive to me. So, but they are the two that the HSCA mentions when they talk about this idea of Oswald working with Bannister. And the HSCA says that it finds neither of them credible. So, but then we go to the third witness, who is also someone that spoke to the HSCA, William Gaudet. And the HSCA, I found it interesting, even though they used what he said when it came to Oswald being in Mexico City, they did not use at all his statement about Oswald speaking to Guy Bannister in front of the International Trade Mart. And what he said is that he saw Oswald and Bannister once. So he only saw him one time, okay? But that he saw him once in deep conversation in front of the International Trade Mart, which is where Gaudet worked. And he said that the two obviously knew each other and it looked like Bannister wanted Oswald to do something. So what's your take on the Gaudet story?
Yeah, well, you know, the one thing we also know from Guy Bannister's brother, I mean, Guy Bannister told his brother that he saw Oswald leafleting outside Trade Mart. And so, and I accept that statement that he probably saw it. And of course, that would be the kind of thing that would greatly interest Guy Bannister. I mean, this sort of anti, you know, pro-communist there, very, very interesting. So he might have gone to talk to Oswald. I have a lot of statements by Gaudet where he actually has no idea what they were talking about, and it's very unclear if they knew each other. But at some point, I'll have to do a blog post on Gaudet. You know, it reminds me of, I used to live in New York City, and this is back in the 80s, and I was on the left, and I was a very, very big critic of Ronald Reagan and what he was doing in Latin and Central America. And I was downtown in Greenwich Village, and there was a demonstration, a little play-acting troupe talking about Reagan's genocide in Central and Latin America. And I went and I talked with the leader of the group, because I told him, you know, I don't like what Reagan is doing, but he's not committing genocide. You have the wrong word. And we had a big disagreement, and then I walked away. And if somebody had taken my picture, they would have said, well, it looks like Fred knows this guy. You know, he's in deep conversation with this guy. I have no idea who this guy is. You know, and so that's what I just take it as, Bannister might have gone over to talk to him.
So you think it's possible that Gaudet did see Bannister talking to him, but that doesn't necessarily prove anything other than that he spoke to him the one time.
Exactly. Okay.
All right. So that's fair. That's fine because, you know, that's kind of what Gaudet said. I mean, you're really just saying that you believe Gaudet for what he said and nothing more. And I know you may not even believe Gaudet at all. But, okay, so your position isn't that that's a false story. It's that the story doesn't prove what it's intended to prove.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, all right. All right, so in addition to – so that's Roberts, Martin, and Gaudet. And those are all ones I kind of lumped them together because they all spoke to the HSCA, although Gaudet is not mentioned in this section. Let's talk about some other supporting witnesses. Now, the first three, I will say my perspective was impacted by reading your counterpoints. So the first three, I think, are, let's say, iffy, okay, for reasons that you will probably put forth here. Professor Michael Kurtz says that he saw Bannister and Oswald debating integration at LSU, which is in Baton Rouge, and that he saw them together again at a restaurant in New Orleans, and he says that Bannister used Oswald's name when he introduced him. Now, Kurtz later wrote another, and I don't know Professor Kurtz, but he later wrote another book, and in that book, he seemed to conflate Oswald with David Ferry in the statements. And, you know, you could say it's an error or whatever, but kind of a big error. Now, this guy is a professor emeritus at Southeastern Louisiana University. So it's not like he's just some totally crazy guy, unless he's such a psychopath that he was able to like trick everyone. But I'm just saying the problem here is, and this again, this is a recurring theme, either Kurtz is telling the truth, or maybe he's exaggerating a little bit, or he's fully psycho. And it's hard for me to jump to this person's a crazy sociopath
Right.
So I guess, so what's your perspective on Kurtz? Anything to add?
Yeah, I don't know if he's psycho, but Pat Spear has a really good chapter on Kurtz on his website, where he really uncovered the fact that there was a lot of claims that Kurtz made about people that he talked to, in which there's just no evidence that it happened. Improper dates of interviews after people supposedly had died. Kurtz is really, really bad on a number of fronts, and I'm sorry to say, I used to buy his books. I still have his books, and but you just can't take anything he wrote seriously anymore because of the errors that Pat Spear has documented on his blog, on his website.
All right, so let's go to Vernon Gerdes. And so Gerdes, am I saying that correctly?
I'm not sure, just like Michu or Homa, I'm Canadian, so I get a lot of this stuff, a lot of this stuff wrong.
Gotcha. All right, well, being American doesn't help. So anyway, when it comes to Cajun stuff, it's all bets are off. All right, so Vernon Gerdes worked for Bannister, and he told his former attorney Stephen Plotkin that he saw Bannister with Oswald. That's the claim. But Gerdes point blank denied seeing Oswald in a 1967 Garrison memo, and then the Plotkin memo, the one that says that Gerdes saw Oswald with Ferry and that Gerdes was an investigator for Plotkin, it doesn't expressly say that Plotkin heard it from Gerdes. So in other words, this whole thing is kind of hearsay. And the implication from the document is that Plotkin did hear about seeing Oswald with Bannister from Gerdes, even though it's expressly stated. Let me just say, to me, the Gerdes thing, it kind of goes back and forth. Then there's also the a year after the Plotkin memo, Gerdes tells the Chambre, the Garrison investigator, that he's never seen Oswald in Bannister's office, point blank. So he tells his lawyer supposedly this one thing, which is that he saw Oswald in Bannister's office. Then he tells Garrison's investigator the opposite of that, and then there's a memo that says the opposite of that before that, and then H to put a cherry on top of the Gerdes story, when he talks to the HSCA, he says that he didn't see Oswald at any time in New Orleans. So there's three times he's on the record saying he did not see Oswald, and there's one time he's on the record saying that, well, there's one time that his attorney is on the record saying that, but it's not super clear. So I pretty much cross Gerdes off in my fact analysis. So this is one I'll give you the W on this one, Fred.
Okay, well, thank you.
I just made your point for you, I
Yeah,
think.
exactly.
All
This is easy.
right. Well, hey, stand by because you'll see here. All right, Tommy, look, man, that's the thing of the beauty about where I'm coming from, like. If I see something that it doesn't make sense to me, then I'll just stop. I'm gonna leave the stuff where there's no evidence for. But anyway, Tommy Baumler, he worked for Bannister, and he says that he saw Oswald with Bannister. So another person says he saw Oswald with Bannister. Now the counterpoint to that is it appears that the only time Baumler told anyone that he saw Oswald with Bannister is December of 1981. In an interview with Bernard Fensterwald and J. Gary Shaw, who, by the way, I've met Gary Shaw a few times. He's always very, very kind to me. But anyway, Baumler did not mention this to during the Garrison investigation. So again, he's got a chance to mention it when it matters, and he doesn't, and he brings it up later. And then Baumler tells Harold Weisberg in the spring of 1968 that he never met Oswald. Harold Weisberg is this big Warren Report critic, first generation researcher. So, to me, Tommy Baumler does seem crazy from the record. There's all these other stories maybe you can speak to. I don't really know what to believe, but the bottom line is that if Baumler is the only one saying this story about they saw Oswald, I wouldn't believe him either. So.
Yeah, he seems to be a fairly incredible character. I mean, I think I have a blog post where I think he's claimed that he heard Oswald and Ruby were opening a restaurant or had opened a restaurant in New Orleans. And that was something he told Garrison. He was an, I think Baumler was an extreme right winger who had some pretty horrible views and liked to tell stories. And so, yeah, he's another one that really, and again, that interview, that supposed interview with J. Gary Shaw in 1981, from what I remember of researching it, there's no real transcript of the interview, or at least if there is, I haven't seen it. There's just a few little notes. And so I'd be really interested in actually seeing a transcript of what he actually said.
Yeah. So those three that I just covered, Baumler, Gerdes, and Kurtz, I would pretty much throw their testimony out when it comes to making a decision on this case, but I still land where I land. So let's talk about that.
Sure.
Mary Bringle, she worked for Bannister and claimed that Delphine Roberts told her that Oswald had been in Bannister's office 2 weeks after the assassination. Again, the claim isn't that Mary Bringle herself saw this. It's that she says Delphine Roberts told her this 2 weeks after the assassination. Now, Bringle did not mention this to Garrison investigators. It's not in the 1967 memo, but it is in, she did write a letter in her own handwriting to the ARRB where she makes this claim. So, you know, what are your thoughts on Mary Bringle?
You know, I've done a lot of work on Mary Bringle. In fact, I have a few more items on Mary Bringle. I'll have to blog the next couple of weeks or whatever. She wrote a lot. She actually talked a lot to a lot of people. Well, she never saw Oswald. And she actually, I think when she worked for Bannister, Oswald would not have been there. So she could not have seen Oswald, and she did. One of the memos that she wrote, when she said that Delphine Roberts was sort of pestering her. Well, you saw Oswald. Come on, you saw him. And Roberts kept on pestering her that you know, you saw him. And of course, she hadn't. And that seems strange. Like, why would Delphine Roberts pester her like that? And I don't know. Look, she didn't see Oswald. And so it's one less witness.
Right. So, but the claim was never that she saw Oswald. The claim was that Delphine Roberts told her that Delphine Roberts had seen Oswald in the office. So my thing, sort of the counterpoint I would make, is that because it's a hearsay statement in the first place, an important statement, but hearsay nonetheless, meaning that she's saying what somebody else said, right? Perhaps that what either she didn't think it was important enough to put in you know, when they talked to her, because she's like, I didn't even see this, or maybe they were asking, or maybe she said what she heard, but they didn't write it down, which is, that's, you know, I don't know. My guess is they probably would have written it down if she said that. But, and then when she had a chance to write it and do her own narrative, then she's kind of like, oh, I'm going to put everything I remember about the case. But
I think she also didn't like Delphine Roberts, and you know, again, I she'd have more credibility. She came forward to the FBI in 1964 and said, oh, by the way, you know, Delphine Roberts told me that Oswald had been in the office.
Mm-hmm.
That would be really credible.
Yeah.
She waits and waits and waits, and then she has this doesn't like Delphine, and says, I don't know, it just seems a bit strange to me.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Right. All right, let's go to Consuela Martin. So she worked for Bannister as a translator, claims that Oswald came to see her more than once to have documents translated there at Bannister's office. And I believe your counterpoint is going to be that Michael Kurtz is where this comes from, so we should just throw it out. You know,
I don't even know her name. I don't even know the story.
Of Consuela Martin?
Yeah, I don't even know her name, so it's another one to add to my list to...
Yeah. That just goes back to, like, either... if it's being made up, then the people making things up are bad actors. Like, they're intentionally making things up.
Yeah.
But... I don't know. It's this is a hard one for me. I wouldn't necessarily throw it out, but you certainly can't hang your hat on it. So anyway,
is there a statement from her? Is there an actual document?
It is the interview with Kurtz, I believe.
I mean, it's just in his book. So well, no actual document.
Yeah, it would be good to get hands on a transcript.
Well, you know, the thing is, if you go into, you can go into the papers of Kurtz online. There's a finding aid for Kurtz's papers.
Mm.
I think what you're going to be disappointed, you'll find that a lot of people he interviewed, there's no transcript or no mention in his papers.
You would just think for someone who's a professor that they would be held to, like their peers would go, "Hey, man, where's the transcript?" But yeah. All right, let's go to the next one. Dan Campbell. There's Dan and Alan Campbell, brothers.
Yep.
Dan, they both worked for Bannister for a period of time. Dan Campbell says that he saw Oswald use the phone at Bannister's office on one occasion, and he told PBS that he did see Oswald in Bannister's office. Yeah, I guess so. What are your thoughts on Dan Campbell?
I'd have to go back to my blog. I actually did a whole workup with Dan, both of them, and I have the complete interview that he did for Frontline, and there was nothing. There was no mention of him working for Bannister or seeing Oswald. I think, yeah, I don't think there's anything to the Campbells, to be honest, of actual evidence that they saw Oswald.
Well, I mean, one of these guys, maybe it was Alan Campbell. He talked to Diogenio, which,
yeah, that's the only source I know that he talked to Diogenio, but he's not on the record as far as I know in any document in saying this.
Okay. So let's talk about Alan Campbell. So again, he, along with his brother, Dan, worked for Bannister, said that he overheard Bannister said to Jim Diogenio that he overheard Bannister tell Delphine Roberts that Oswald was part of Bannister's office after she complained to Bannister about seeing Oswald hand out these pro-Castro materials. This was in a 1994 interview. So, you know, the counterpoint is that Campbell, and I think this is what you're getting at, expressly denied this to PBS Frontline. But he did say this other thing to Diogenio, and I understand people had different perspectives about him, but I do not think he would make something up and misrepresent what someone's saying, and just full cloth make it up. But it would be good to see transcripts for everything. So, all right. George Higginbotham. So another one of Bannister's investigators said that Bannister told him that Oswald worked for him after Higginbotham told Bannister about the guy handing out pro-Castro materials in front of the trademark. Any thoughts on Higginbotham?
Yeah, Higginbotham is sort of another character like Tony Baumler, who said a whole variety of things which seemed to be impossible or ridiculous. I did a blog post on Higginbotham as well. I'd have to go back to it. There's a big memo about some of the stuff he said, and some of the stuff is nonsense. Again, I just find this too incredible to believe.
So the
another person didn't come forward.
Right. Right. Yeah. So let's throw out the three that we sort of agreed were not credible. I'm talking Gerdes, Baumler, and Kurtz. Looking at all the others, including Delphine Roberts and Jack Martin, ultimately they did make statements at some point. Now you can always be, well, I don't believe they actually made that statement. You could say that. But it appears that they did make statements, even though they failed to say the substantive thing they were saying in earlier statements. My question is, this gets back to the motive question. I mean, why would they all say that after the fact if they knew it wasn't true, or if they weren't sure if it was true?
Why would Beverly Oliver say she's the babushka lady?
Why I think Richard... individual people can be crazy.
You know, there's all these people who are saying stuff. I mean, I can give you a long, long list of people who say things.
I'm with you, but the numbers of it all is the issue. So individual crazy people...
That's the problem here, is that people go by the quantity. I'm more interested in the quality.
Sure.
So, I mean, I see this all the time. Where people, I've got 19 witnesses who say this. Well, mm-hmm. I have to go through every single one to show you that it's all nonsense.
All right, let's go to just so you know, from my perspective, these witnesses we just laid out, if that was the only thing, my confidence in my position would not be nearly as strong. Okay. But there's more, right? So let's talk about these other things. And this is tying in the 544 Camp Street and all these things. Okay. So let's jump to that.
Okay.
So let's talk 544 Camp Street and whether or not it proves an association between Oswald and Bannister. So we have this stamp. So first of all, let me say this. I think to your credit, you've done a fair job of pointing out that the stamp is not on all these flyers. It's on one. It's on the Corliss Lamont document.
That's right.
And sometimes,
and then the fact that Oliver Stone, both in the movie and the documentary series, use a fake handbill.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, why fake a handbill? With it seems like you need that in that evidence.
Yeah, I think that the accurate information should be out there for sure. I'm not sure how. Well, it is. If you're making it seem like it was more of a pattern than it actually was, then sure, I can understand how that would affect the substance of the argument. But so 544 Camp Street, the stamp is on the back of this Corliss Lamont, case for Cuba, or the kit,
that's right,
the crime against Cuba.
Whatever it is,
And it's now it's the fourth edition. That's the edition of the pamphlet that's out at the time that that Oswald has this, that Oswald's handing these pamphlets out, but he has a first edition copy and we don't know where he got those from. Have you looked at that issue, or do you know where he got, because we know where he got the other pamphlets from. He got them from the print shop that's near Riley Coffee, but we don't really know about the provenance of where those Corliss Lamont pamphlets came from, do we?
Well, he got them from the Fair Play for Cuba committee.
Like in the mail?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a document that traces that back? I have not seen that.
Well, he talks about there are documents where he wants to order more copies of that pamphlet.
I recall I've seen the documents where he writes them and he's asking for materials, but I have not seen anything where the materials were actually delivered. But you're just you have to assume that that's a reasonable place he got it from. Fair enough. So you may have heard this, you may know this, that the CIA actually ordered 45 copies of the first edition and that they had. This is kind of, it's an interesting, and there's, the document that exists. But I guess my question is, if the Fair Play for Cuba committee is sending them to him, they just had vintage ones, and because they're Fair Play for Cuba, they ordered the first ones when they came out. That could be the counterpoint to how he has in his possession a first edition document when really it should be fourth edition if you ordered it from a print shop.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think if you order it from the Fair Play for Committee, who knows how they kept their inventory, first in, or last in, first out, who knows? So they're probably just picking it off the shelf and they pick an old one, a new one, whatever,
Mm-hmm. So that is it's kind of an open question, but I follow your point there. All right, so Dean, so Oswald's handing these flyers out. Dean Andrews told the Warren Commission that he saw Oswald handing out materials, and Oswald told him he was being paid to hand the materials out. How do you respond to that?
Man, a guy who's getting paid by the CIA and paid for this, he had no money. I'll tell you, I have to laugh because you have all these people who were supposedly tied with the CIA who were incredibly poor. David Ferry was mine. Talk about poverty. That man lived in poverty despite being this incredible CIA agent. They never paid him. So look, there is no relationship between 544 Camp Street and Oswald. And And Bannister. I mean, Bannister was at 531 Lafayette.
Well, that's downstairs. It's the same building.
It's not the same building, but they're not connected.
They have different doors. That's true.
What? No, they're not connected.
I agree with you. They have different entrances.
So if you, in the summer of 1963, I mean, if you went to 544 Camp Street, all you would find would be two union offices.
Right. And so there right.
So, was. So, I so mean, the... I see, I think the reason, I mean, I don't know why Oswald's the only, and by the way, when he used 544 Camp Street on the Lamont pamphlets, it was with the FPCC. Now, maybe Oswald had gotten some old flyers from the CRC at Carlos Bringier's office, and he saw the Camp Street address, and he thought, you know, wouldn't this be funny? Maybe he didn't know they weren't there anymore. Wouldn't this be funny if I sent a few people looking for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee up to the CRC office? Maybe that's what he was thinking. Or maybe he actually, for a while, he thought he would rent an office there and wanted to see how it looked on these pamphlets. I don't know.
But to respond to the point about 531 Lafayette and 544 Camp being different places, and your point about there's only two tenants at the time, the witnesses say that there were those offices were, you know, they saw Fair Play for Cuba flyers in one of the offices. And so in other words, the offices could have been used by Bannister, who had the entire first floor. It's not crazy to think that some of his folks would go up there and use some of these empty offices from time to time. That's all I'm saying. So it's not totally
right. And I think that if there were, you know, flyers in Bannister's office, and again, if he saw Oswald giving out those flyers, he may have picked up a couple. And yeah, so they're in his office. But that, I don't see any evidence of anything more than that.
Back to Dean Andrews. So he was paying, Oswald said he's being paid $25 a day, which was basically double what he was making at Riley Coffee, I believe.
It's good work if you can get it.
Maybe it was one and a half times. It was more. My question is, so you just totally dismissed that statement?
Well, Dean Andrews says all sorts of stuff. I mean,
in a fun way, here, too.
We could sit here forever and parse Dean Andrews' statements, and you'll say, I agree with that. I don't like that one. There's lots of statements out there. That man liked to talk.
Okay.
And he was a really good talker.
But just so that, you know, the audience can follow how we end up agreeing so much and landing in different places, I put emphasis on that particular statement because it's not like Dean Andrews is saying, hey, you know, cool cat, the green giant is whatever. It's not like he's just saying some cryptic thing. He point blank told the Warren Commission that. So now you can argue credibility, you can argue yada yada yada, but the point is I do put some weight in that, and it's fair to say you kind of dismiss that. Yeah,
I dismiss it because there's no evidence that Oswald was paid, and we have a pretty good accounting of Oswald's finances. And again, so we, you know, I don't, who would pay him? Why would you pay him for that? Who would do it?
Right. Well, I mean, if he was working for Bannister, that's who would pay him. Right. So
Bannister was broke.
That's what the argument.
Couldn't pay his rent.
But if Bannister was a conduit for other funds, I'm just saying, like, so.
No, I know, but you can't find that connection. There's no connection between Bannister and the CIA. But you're implying it, and you're saying maybe he paid Oswald, but of course we have no evidence that Oswald got the money.
Well, there are connections with Bannister and the CIA in the form of Joe Oster, just one little name, said that Bannister was a conduit of CIA funds. Bannister worked for Sergio Arcacha Smith, did work vetting people for his organization, and Sergio Arcacha Smith's organization was funded by the CIA, was it not?
Yeah, and that's a very indirect relationship. And again, that goes back to the early, you know, an earlier part of Bannister and not 1963.
Yeah. And then you've got the HOMA stuff, to your point, it is earlier.
Bannister... The HOMA stuff happened. That did happen.
Right. But Bannister, to say, I mean, I don't know that you can conclusively rule out the CIA, given all the folks around him. But I agree that there's not
It's not a matter of ruling it out. I can't rule it in because there's actually no evidence for it. Mm. So without any evidence, what can I conclude? That, you know, if you want to show me the evidence, I'm willing to concede that point. But nobody has the evidence.
All right. Well, let's keep rolling here. So Jesse Corr,
right.
Clay Shaw's right hand man. Is that a fair statement? Maybe if I'm overstating that, feel free to edit it.
Yeah.
But Jesse Corr, he worked at the trademark with Clay Shaw. He obtains one of these Corliss Lamont pamphlets, and he sends a copy of the pamphlet to the New Orleans FBI. And he writes a note on the front that says, "Note the inside back cover," which is where the 544 Camp Street stamp was. What are your thoughts on the meaning of that?
I guess he thought it was a clue. I don't know. I haven't seen that myself, where he said that. I do have a fair number of Jesse Corps statements, which Jesse Corps, actually have a really great document of Jesse Corps talking about Clay Shaw being a firm admirer of John Kennedy. Doesn't mean much to me.
So, well, I mean, what it means to me is he's sending notice to the FBI of, hey, look, he's pointing out this address. He's pointing out the stamp and letting them know about it, which to me, I view that as he's going, hey, this is a problem. You need to go talk to your boy and get him to stop stamping 544 Camp Street on things.
Well, no, that's not my interpretation. I mean, if that happened, I mean, it would just say, yeah, he's being a good guy and saying, hey, here's a clue for you.
Okay.
I do think that the FBI should have investigated 544 Camp Street more. I think there could have been a much bigger investigation of the address and to nail down some of the specifics about, you know, what was going on there with who, et cetera, et cetera. So I do think that there's, and so why not? Why not tell, hey, you know, this was in front of Oswald was here. Here is an address for you to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It's right around the corner from us.
Are you familiar with Charles Steele?
Yep.
So Charles Steele, this is the guy that Oswald finds him near the unemployment office, I believe.
Yep.
And he pays him to hand out flyers with him while he's on TV for WDSU. Oswald offered Steele $2 for about 15, 20 minutes of work. Steele later refused to tell the HSCA investigators whether or not he was aware of Oswald before the incident. So my question on this is, what are the chances that Oswald picks a guy from the employment office to help him hand out flyers, and that guy ends up being an FBI informant? And then how could Oswald afford to pay someone to help him hand out flyers if he's living on these paltry unemployment checks? And oh, by the way, what's the point of paying somebody for 20 minutes of handing out flyers? I would say it's because he knew that he was about to be on film and he wanted to make it look like a bigger operation. And that someone else gave him the money would be the answer, because he doesn't have money. But what is your take on that?
Well, Steele said that he gave out flyers for a short period of time, and when he saw it was all about, he threw a bunch of them in the garbage and walked away. So my take is that, Oswald could afford a menial amount. I mean, he could afford to print up flyers. He could afford small little things, he didn't have a lot of money, and we know that. So I don't really read anything into it at all.
Okay. The next thing. Just the sheer amount of people with FBI or CIA connections surrounding Oswald during this saga where he's handing out the flyers and WDSU gets it on TV and, everything that was connected to that. So we just said Charles Steele, FBI informant, Jesse Corps, FBI informant, Charles Bringier, the guy that Oswald got into a scuffle with, is an FBI informant. He's also part of AMSPEL, the CIA operation.
Yeah, well, I have to say, if you actually go through the Garrison files, what you'll find is a revolving door of people going in to see Garrison and telling them something, and then not running to the FBI and telling them something, and then running back to Garrison and telling him something. Everybody, I mean, it's a small place, and everybody was running. There's a massive amount of gossip and talk in New Orleans, and people were running to and from the FBI and to and from Garrison's office. Okay.
Well, but wait, there's more. Okay. So the two other Cubans with Bringier when he's arrested were also linked to intelligence. Miguel Cruz was an FBI informant. Kelso Hernandez was a CIA asset. The cameraman, Orvi Aucoin, who filmed Oswald handing out the flyers, was an FBI informant. Bill Stuckey, the radio host of the show Oswald went on, was an FBI informant.
So what? I mean,
Butler, who he debated.
Yeah, I mean, who FBI? When you say the term FBI informant, I mean, it means they supplied some information to the FBI. Sure. So what? Why wouldn't they? I mean, a loyal American should supply information to the FBI. Why not? It doesn't bother me in the slightest. I mean, the problem is a lot of people on the left are like, oh, I hate the FBI or I hate the CIA. But a lot of loyal Americans, why not? Why wouldn't you go call the FBI with information?
Tipster is different than an informant, is it not? Is
Oh,
it like
no, an informant is just somebody who's going to call the FBI. I got some information for you.
doesn't an informant imply that has an inf that has a identified informant number imply an ongoing relationship? Or you would say no.
Well, I don't know if it may or may not apply. I mean, they get, I see that the same thing with on the CIA front. I mean, for instance, you could take somebody like Dan, the reporter for the Miami Herald who covered Cuba, Dan Boering, and he had a CIA asset number. But when you asked him about it, what is that asset number? He said, well, look, I was always talking to the CIA about the stories I'm working on. I wanted information from them. So I don't, so they had a number for me. What can I, it's nothing to do with me. So sometimes, I mean, look, any good America, there's stuff going on. There's lots of people who, contact the police might be, because of your position, you might contact the police multiple times. They know who you are.
Yeah, I just for me, it's the numbers. Like, I hear what you're saying, and
Yeah, it's always, but it's.
it's like, yeah, there's a lot of FBI and CIA, assets and informants, but everybody's, what are the chances that everybody surrounding him on this thing is? It's like a Truman Show type scenario is what it feels like to me.
Well, whatever. I mean, but again, I've been struck by, the fact that, there was that revolving door between the FBI and don't forget, I think a lot of people were horrified by what Garrison was doing. And so, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to speak to the FBI. I mean, this was this madman in New Orleans going after all these innocent people. Yeah, I'm going to call the FBI. I'm pissed off.
Let's we kind of been going here for a while, but can you go like another 15 minutes or so at
Sure,
least? Okay.
yeah.
All right. I want to see if we can touch on Clinton Jackson real quick,
Oh, okay, sure. That's a good one.
without unpacking every single
Yeah.
thing here.
Yep.
Big picture, Oswald gets a haircut from McGehee. Then he talks about wanting the job at first of all. The person that's just for the sake of ease here, when I say Oswald, the person that's allegedly Oswald, okay, all right, gets a haircut from McGehee, and then says he wants to get a job at the hospital, and then McGehee says, oh, you should go talk to the state rep, Reeves Morgan. Reeves Morgan says that Oswald told him the same story, and he then sent him to go register to vote in Clinton. And then, oh, look, Henry Palmer and John Manchester. John Manchester sees the Cadillac and says that he sees Shaw, but Henry Palmer says he sees Oswald, talks to him, he shows the Navy ID card, and he, again, same story, talks about the hospital. And then we have some folks at the hospital that say that there was a file with Oswald's name that was found there. So the reason that I believe Oswald did go to generally the Clinton Jackson story is true, is that you've got all these different people saying the same common thread, and I understand the counterpoints, and I'm happy for you to make them here, but I just don't get how the story about the hospital would be involved unless they're all nefariously making it up. It goes back to
Right.
like these people have to
Well,
be
I
bad
don't.
actors. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you read my 20-part series on Clinton?
I've read mo much of it. I think I've read all of it, but go
Okay.
ahead.
Well, to me, I mean, I don't believe Oswald was there at all, and of course, Shaw and Ferry weren't there either. I think the whole story was concocted. I don't know exactly by who, but I think Jack Rogers had something to do with it, and I think it was largely concocted to get Garrison off of the habit of blaming the CIA and steering him the direction of the left, because these were some extreme right-wingers who were upset about Garrison's direction. I don't understand if Oswald really wanted a job, and he knew Clay Shaw. One phone call, he would have had a really good job working at the trademark somewhere. Why Oswald would want to go work in a KKK city with some really horrible people is beyond me. I just don't get it at all. And I'm struck by the fact that Michael Lesser, who was the core worker who was arrested at the same time in Clinton, looks incredibly like Oswald. And in fact, the first rumor about Oswald being there was from one woman who thought she saw Oswald, not other people. And I think that she just mistook Lesser. And of course, then she died. And when she died, it became very, very possible to sort of graft that story into a much larger story.
Okay, but and I've read your piece on that, but my question is still, wouldn't that mean that all these people are not telling the truth then?
Yes, yeah, so I think the story was most of these people were KKK people. I mean, talk about conspiracy minded people. Somebody concocted this story and put it together, a fairly simple story, and got these people to go along with it. I'll tell you one thing that's really striking, and I haven't written about this much. Had there been discovery in the Louisiana courts back when Garrison brought his prosecution, that is, if Garrison had to give over all of his investigative memos to the Shaw's attorneys, I don't think he would have called the Clinton witnesses to the stand. Because when you look at those initial statements by all of those people, the inconsistencies is just incredible. And had Shaw's attorneys known about those inconsistencies, these people would have been shredded on cross-examination. I don't think Garrison would have brought these people into the trial at all.
All right. Well, I mean,
I think we can do a whole show.
Yeah, we could do a whole show on Clinton Jackson. But I mean, I know you don't agree with my perspective. Do you understand the kind of the point I'm making of like, it feels more conspiratorial to me
definitely.
These people are all making it up.
It's a conspiracy. I mean, and again, because it's a KKK town, these are KKK people who are easily entering into a conspiracy. And they did so in this case. I don't know exactly who put it all together, but I do know it's a fault. The whole thing is completely false and made up.
But the KKK, I take that Manchester and Henry Palmer, right?
McGehee, they're all okay. They're all KKK people.
Is Reeves Morgan KKK?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
if not KKK, then a sympathizer. I mean, they knew they're all, you know.
The hospital ladies, are they KKK?
Well, the hospital ladies were you know, again, less, you know, their claims are like they saw an Oswald file. But when you really look at some of the claims, it sort of dissipates because, number one, nobody could find the file. Other people aren't really sure about it. I don't think they were part of the conspiracy there. But I discount their evidence.
Yeah.
No evidence.
We'll leave it at that. In terms of Clinton Jackson. So is it your position that Clay Shaw did not know David Ferry at all? Let me just step back.
Yeah.
Maybe they knew each other, but they weren't like friends.
They weren't friends. Maybe he knew of him. I don't think he knew him. I don't think Ferry knew Oswald. Ferry didn't know, Ferry didn't know Shaw. Shaw didn't know Ferry. I mean, all of this stuff is, there's nothing there.
All right, so let's throw some little factoids here that you can bat down. So there's an FBI informant and the owner of the Habana Bar in New Orleans, Orest Pena, who says that he saw Ferry and Shaw together there on many occasions. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, you could say you saw them on many occasions. I haven't seen that report about Orest Pena saying that. I'd like to see the actual primary document.
Okay. It's cited on my transcripts. I can get it to you. But
yeah, send me the primary document. But
then there's another one. Nicholas and Matilda Tadine. This story, I'm sure you're familiar with it. But basically, they were parents that wanted to get their kid a flying lesson with David Ferry. They bring him out to the airport, and they see Ferry walking out of the hangar talking to Clay Shaw. And the reason I don't just go, mistaken identity, is because Tadine already knew who Clay Shaw was. He recognized him as the director of the trademark. So thoughts on that interaction?
Yeah, I did a whole workup on the Tadines, and actually they did take flying lessons from Ferry. So I actually found a nice little document with Ferry and the son. Yeah, I discount that as well. I don't think that, you know, for whatever reason, there was some reason they came forward, but I discount that as well.
All right, Clay Shaw's attorney.
I have to go back and read my actual blog post on the Tadeens. It has a lot to do with when they came forward.
Okay. Clay Shaw's attorney is commissioned a report by the Wackenhut Detective Agency. And in that report, Sandra Anderson, a secretary for G. Ray Gill, said that she had seen a photo of Shaw and Ferry together.
Okay,
that's
let's
not
see
a
the photo.
Huge. Right.
No, so, yeah. Let's see the photo.
Right.
And that goes the
it
other
disappeared.
Thing. I can't, you know, Richard Case Nagel said that he had a photo of Oswald in New Orleans. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's see the photo. You know, there's all this non-existent evidence that people like to cite.
Right. But it just goes back to my core theme of why would they make it up? But
yeah, and I don't know. I don't know why. You know, that's a good question. You'll have to answer that yourself. But I mean, there are reasons, and who knows?
Shaw's former secretary at the trademark, Aura Lee, said that she had seen David Ferry enter
so this,
Shaw's
have you read
office.
My blog post on Aura Lee. First off, you have to get that was her first name, Aura Lee.
Okay.
DOG didn't even get the name right.
Go ahead.
And she wasn't. She worked for the Italian section there. And if you actually read my report on Aura Lee aloft, she did not see anything. It's all hearsay about what she said. There's actually no statement directly from her.
So it's somebody else saying what they heard her say, basically.
Somebody else saying, you know.
Fair enough. And then the last thing, what this whole thing of this is a Shaw and Oswald connection, but I just want to get your thoughts on this. There's a document that Lillian Moret told Mark Lane. I know Mark Lane. So that's Oswald's aunt. That Clay Shaw came to her door looking for Lee in late September of 1963. Have you ever seen this document?
I haven't seen that document. When did she say that and to who?
She said it to Mark Lane.
Oh, okay. And when did she say that?
68, late 68, I believe.
Yeah, is there an actual memo on that?
Yeah, there is. I will, I'll get it.
Tell me that memo.
You.
I'd like to blog that one.
Yeah. Okay, right on. And look, there's a zillion memos. And again, I know you don't have every single one of them in front of you, so right on. All right. Just really quick here to wrap up. I just want to go Shaw versus Bertrand real quick. And then overall case. Go ahead.
Well, the thing about Shaw and Bertrand, I don't understand why Clay Shaw would use the name Clay Bertrand when he was planning the assassination and then keep on using that name for years afterwards. That seems like really a crazy activity to me.
Keep using the name Clay Bertrand for years afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, why would he go to the VIP room and sign Clay Bertrand 3 years after he used that pseudonym to plan the assassination?
Sure. Yeah, because there are a few of these folks that, first of all, there's the Dean Andrews story to Harold Weisberg. And
yeah, I blogged that. Have you read? I mean,
I did. I read it.
That one's really, really, for people to cite that as evidence,
My take is that probably a different take than you on it. I don't think it's absolutely conclusive that he didn't mean that. I think it's, you could argue that he did mean that, but man, it's murky and it's definitely not, it's not straightforward at all. So what his, his statement was, the actual quote, that Weisberg's talking to Dean Andrews and, you know, asking him, you know, if Shaw was Bertrand, and Andrews' response was that if the green giant gets past that, he's home clear or something like that.
Yeah, and here's the funny thing of that is not only do you have Dean Andrews with his jibe talk, but you've got Harold Weisberg with his Weisbergian talk as well. And so when Dean Andrews meets Harold Weisberg, oh my God, you get this incredible clash of, I don't know, the combination of
language.
Of jive West, you know, Weisbergian.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, to me, like, that's how Dean Andrews talked. So
yeah, we also have Weisberg's the way he wrote, which is also
right
pretty bad as well.
And also, when this quote, this is him writing to Joan Mellon, him trying to remember something from, you know, years and years ago. So
yeah,
but anyway, the point is that it's not an absolute slam dunk that Andrews told Weisberg that. You gotta put an asterisk next to that. There's the Jesse Parker VIP story. That's your point you were making. There's the Thomas Breitner, the guy at Berkeley that says he saw Shaw, but he didn't. And then Shaw introduced himself as Clay Bertram, but he didn't say that until the third time he spoke to Garrison's office, which kind of that does undercut it a bit. Now here's the big one, Habeckhorst. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a whole back and forth. It's a ping pong game of how this, and then there's this counterpoint. So again, we could go super deep on just Habeckhorst, but I guess, you know, there's this guy Butzman, Jonas Butzman, and it's his job to escort Shaw everywhere, you know, at the police department, so he doesn't get killed basically. And he says, if you believe what Butzman says, that he's there the whole time. There's two instances, one where it's crowded and there's a bunch of people there, but that's not the time where they said that the Bertram name was written. And the other one was in a small room with just Habeckhorst and Butzman, he says, and some other folks. Now, some other folks, one or two other people. Habeckhorst says that Butzman was in and out of the room. So it all comes down to, this is another one of these, why would he lie? that I'm hanging my hat on. So Habeckhorst basically said that Butzman was in and out. And if Butzman really was in and out, then they wouldn't know. Now, incidentally, that he wouldn't know if Bertram had told him that. Now, Bertram, Clay Shaw had told him that. Now, Shaw says that he signed off on the card when it was blank. Okay. Which if that's true, then, you know, who knows, but I guess, you know, there was an internal investigation that found that Habeckhorst had no wrongdoing, although the judge did not believe Habeckhorst. So, you have a take on why Habeckhorst may have not told the truth. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, basically, it has to do with, he had some animosity towards Irvin Diamond. In relation to one of his relatives in a case that he thought Irvin Diamond had not performed well. So there was sort of a grudge against Diamond. Whether that was the reason, I don't know. I just found another document I'll have to post of Clay Shaw's attorney's memo of speaking to another police officer who said that, you know, the way we do these things is you don't ask questions, you just fill it out from the other forms, et cetera, et cetera. I find it sort of incredible to believe that you're sitting down with Clay Shaw. What's your alias? Oh yeah, Clay Bertrand. I find that just really, really hard to believe that Clay Shaw would do that.
The only way it would make sense is if he wasn't thinking and he was like on autopilot and he said it not thinking. That's the only scenario where it's plausible. But I just, it's interesting the theory that, hey, maybe Habeckhorst did this to get back.
Let's go beyond Habeckhorst. So I'll keep on asking you and everybody else, what's the evidence that Clay Shaw conspired to kill Kennedy?
Oh, let's segue to that. So again, I land on Habeckhorst. I land on Shaw being Bertram, but it's a closer call. It's a close call, and it's because I don't know that I can just throw out what Habeckhorst says. That's a big gamble to throw away your whole career on a small vendetta for your brother. I mean, I don't, maybe it wasn't small in his eyes.
You help your career. You're actually doing something for Garrison. You actually are going to help your career.
Garrison's the DA. He's not the police office.
Yeah, but he had a lot of pull in that city. Are you kidding me? Mm. He had the police. Everybody was under his thumb.
I'll have to see a site for that, Fred. So, all right. Let's move on to your core point here. And thank you for, you know, you're the one who challenged me to this debate, but thanks for your time. And what is the evidence against Garrison? I mean, against Clay Shaw conspiring to kill Kennedy? My view is that I would have voted not guilty if I was a juror. So my ultimate conclusion in this case is that I did not believe Garrison's argument. And the reason why is that I just find it implausible that Clay Shaw would be talking to Ferry and Oswald. Okay. With Perry Russo just sitting there. I mean, I think Sylvia Marr put it the best when she said, she said, and we're to believe that they're just going to leave this loose end hanging out there that saw everything. So I don't believe that. I think Garrison lost the case basically when David Ferry died. Anything that he would have had really would have been on the Ferry side of thing, possibly. I understand you don't believe the Ferries.
Well, I think actually David Ferry's death allowed Garrison to make up things. If David Ferry had not died, then Garrison really wouldn't be able to say a lot of the things he would say, because you'd have Ferry there saying, no, that's just not true. But yeah. It gave Garrison a lot of leeway, I think.
But so ultimately, I mean, look, Shaw did have CIA ties. He was an asset for a period of time. There's a big debate about how much and to what extent, et cetera, but he was a CIA asset. And he traveled abroad, and that's not necessarily weird. So I understand that too. What was I going to say on Shaw? I think he may have known some stuff, potentially, but I don't think he had any involvement in the planning or the plotting. I think, and also as a true Warren Report critic here, I don't think Oswald fired any shots. So in my view, like, if you come from that perspective, it's not consistent internally to the thing. Like, how do you have this guy, you know, doing, it's like, I want to believe everything. And also want to believe the Garrison argument. Well, you can't, you got to pick your battles that make sense to me. So that's kind of where I come down. So we agree that Garrison shouldn't have won the case, but for
it's
very
also
different
a question. The question I also ask people is, what was the evidence that Garrison had that Shaw conspired when he arrested Shaw?
This is all back to Perry Russo, correct?
Yeah, and that's the sad part, is all he had was the memory of Perry Russo after he had been hypnotized twice. He was going to still be hypnotized after Shaw was arrested, and the use of sodium pentothal.
Yeah, and that's it.
And that, I don't know why people aren't more bothered by that.
Well, Perry Russo and Chambra both said that they discussed these things in their first meeting. However, the document trail does not show that. When you look at the document trail, it's you know, you go, oh, this doesn't look good for your argument, because who's going to not put down the headline and then go, oh, I didn't write that the first time, but here's the main point, which I'm putting the second time. I agree, that doesn't seem plausible. And then the biggest thing to me on why I don't have the perspective that Garrison was acting in bad faith. I think he actually was. I think he thought that Shaw is connected to the CIA. There's the conspiracy, but he didn't know. He didn't really have the details filled in, and he was just kind of trying to go from there. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and there's another point we could discuss even further in another episode. But did Shaw? I don't know what Garrison thought about this. It's funny that Alcock did not ask Shaw any questions about his relationship with the CIA. The only question about the CIA asked of Shaw at the trial was asked by his own attorney. It's sort of strange that Garrison did not want to probe that at all under oath. Yeah. And that leads into the whole story about Permandex and CMC, which I love to talk about, which is a whole other topic.
I have to study that more before I talk about that with you. But
yeah, it's a really good one, because I think I have more primary documents on Permandex and CMC than any other researcher out there. And so I like talking about it. In fact, it's one of the, when I get a new conspiracy book, it's one of the first things I look for is, what is the footnotes for your stuff on Permandex?
Hey, let me ask you one last question, if I could. What are your thoughts on the witnesses who say that David Ferry came around looking for Oswald, asking about Oswald's library card after the assassination?
Well, I did a blog post on that, and I think that, look, he did. He went around asking about his library card. Look, David Ferry realized, what's really interesting is when he was first asked by the FBI about Oswald, he sort of said, well, you know, I don't really know him, but he looks familiar. And then that night he spoke to Edward Vobel, who told Ferry, you know, look, you served with Oswald in CAP. I was there. You served together. And that sort of jogged his memory. And the next day, Ferry calls the FBI to tell them, you know what, we were together in CAP. Now, that's really rare for a suspect to actually call the FBI with information that connects him to Oswald. Look, he had parties at his house for CAP people. And I think he realized that there might have been all these cat people at his house. Jack Martin had made this rumor that Oswald had Ferry's library card. And so I think Ferry wondered, was he perhaps at one of my parties and I didn't know it, and he stunk off with my card or stole my card. And so that's what got him interested in that.
Yeah, but why would he think that Oswald stole his card?
Well, because Jack Martin had talked about it. And so how else could Oswald have Ferry's card? He thought, well, you know, I have these parties. There's lots of people from CAP there. I don't know them all. And maybe at one of those parties, Oswald took it.
So, in other words, you would say that out of an abundance of caution, he was worried that he would get blamed because of this prior association.
He wanted to know if it was true and if there's any way to confirm this or not. And, of course, it wasn't true at all.
Mm. So there you go, man. That's let's leave it on that. Those are the inference splits. I mean, so it's just I think there may be a couple of points here and there where you and I are like, oh,
yeah, it was good.
Let's show me that document. But I think we've kind of laid out the differences in our perspectives. And
yeah, it was very good. It was civil and it was a lot of fun. And I'd love to come back on. I particularly would like to come back on and talk about CMC and Permadex, because I think people should know more about what really happened there. It's a really interesting story.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch, Fred. And you want to plug any books or your website or anything?
Oh, I have my website is onthetrailofdelusion.com, and my new book is A Heritage of Nonsense, Jim Garrison's Tales of Mystery and Imagination. And I've got 9 conspiracy stories, including Richard K. Snagel and Rose Cherami, which I debunk. So it's kind of a fun book.
All right. Well, hey, we appreciate it. And Solving JFK listeners, we'll be back in a few months. We may come back with a bonus episode, possibly, but otherwise, look for something from us in February or March. Have a good one.
Great. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Clark's Herbal Remedies. Anytime my old high school football knee injury is acting up, Clark's Herbal Remedies All Natural Pain Cream is my go-to for fast relief. This stuff doesn't come from a factory. It's small batch and handcrafted by an herbalist who sources the best ingredients from around the world. In my experience, this pain cream from Clark's Herbal Remedies really works. You can order a jar today at clarksherbs.com. Use discount code JFK for 20% off. That's clarksherbs.com.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.